Hello and welcome to our case study call for NEPT, Nutritional Endocrinology Practitioner Training. I want to welcome all of you new people to this. This might be your very first case study call, in which case you're in for a treat. The way that these calls work is that people submit cases in advance, and usually we can handle up to two because we do a really thorough treatment and look at the labs and the history that somebody submitted and gives you an idea of how to proceed from start to finish through a call and what kind of questions I might be asking. So we have two of them, and I think both of them are submitted for the person itself, which in a lot of programs, they don't let you submit cases on yourself. They say you have to do it on patients, but in reality, I think I actually like it better when you submit cases for yourself because I ask lots of questions. And if you haven't asked those questions of your patient or client, then I don't get the answers until you say, okay, I'll make a note to go back. So on the one hand, it teaches you some great strategies, but on the other hand, it teaches you, looks like somebody started to share their screen with me. Who's sharing their screen? Anyway, somebody just tried to share their screen with me. And on the one hand, it's good that you learn a strategy for dealing with the patient. But on the other hand, you probably haven't asked some of the questions that I'm going to ask. So it helps to have you there. So everybody listening to that case actually gets to see the kind of questions I ask. And then when I get an answer, what's the next set of questions? Now, all of the question and answer history taking is in our history taking module, which I believe is module 5. Lynn can correct me if I'm wrong. I can't remember module numbers, but it's basically very in-depth. Like, how do you get a good history that helps you get to the root cause, not just make a diagnosis and put somebody in a box? So that's what we're here to do, and we have two cases that were submitted today. One was from Susan D. Desmarais, is that how you say your name? I never know. I just call you Susan.
Desmarais.
Okay, there you go. I totally botched it. So sorry there. And then we have Mary Lynn Thompson. So, and both of them have submitted GIFX and oat tests. So that's pretty cool as well. So I'm opening these up, make sure that you guys are going to be able to see them. Do either of you have, like, you have to leave by a certain time, or are you good to go for, you know, because I'll pick the one to go first.
I'm okay with time. It's Susan.
Okay, Susan. How about you, Mary Lynn? Are you okay with time?
I'm okay, too.
Okay, good. Okay, so Susan, and Susan case entry. Okay. These were all up last night in anticipation of this, but then as inevitably happens, you know, Windows decides to reboot itself, and so now I have to open them up again. So I'm opening them up again. And I have them all in one window, and I'll share that window with you guys. And we'll go from there. I think we'll start with Susan, and let me do share screen. There's this weird box at the bottom of my screen, so let me move the share so that it doesn't overlap that box, because the box is, I can't get rid of it. It's just this gray box, and it's covering things up. So I'm going to hit share screen, and then I'm going to choose the Susan case study, and I'm going to put this down, and I'm going to say share screen, and so you should be able to see it. I've already hit the record, so you'll be able to see that. And then Susan, you know, you guys can open yourselves. I love that about the Zoom windows that you guys can open up your own lines, whereas on Maestro, you can't. So if you're on Maestro, you're welcome to stay there because some people, we keep the both going. We're probably going to eventually phase it out and get you, make sure you have all the phone numbers for Zoom because Zoom can be done on a phone as well. But I want to make sure that, if you have questions, and I'm going to put the hands down, if you have, I put everybody's hands down on Maestro. So as we're going through, if you have questions, I want to first check in to make sure that you're hearing me, but go ahead and speak, Susan, and let's make sure that they hear you as well. So go ahead and speak, Susan.
Hi there, everybody.
Okay. So if you heard Susan say, hi there, everybody, raise your hand on Maestro. And any number from 1 to 5 will raise your hand. Good. Okay, cool. Now I'm going to open up somebody's line on Maestro and make sure you guys on Zoom can hear them. And let me just shrink this window a little. gets to be like this feat of technology to just have all these windows open and figure out how to use them. So forgive me if I'm a little hesitant there. But all right, so Karen. Hi, Karen. Go ahead and speak, and we're going to find out if Susan can hear you. Oops, I opened up your line. There.
Hello?
Hi. Good. You're a little bit, like, botchy. Are you on a cell phone?
Yes.
Okay. So just say, like, a sentence so that we can tell if Susan can hear you okay.
Hi, Susan. Can you hear me?
I can, although it sounds like you're in a tin can.
Yeah, it sounds that way to me, too. So it's not the technology. It's the connection, I guess. So thank you. Thank you, Susan and Karen. The test is now complete. So I am going to start. So you can you see my screen, Susan? Can you see your case up there?
Yes, I can.
Okay. So for those of you who are new, there is a case study submission form, and it's on the resources tab. And Lynn, if I say where it's at and I'm wrong, just interrupt me and tell me where it really is. But I believe it's on the resources tab. That is the case study submission form. And if you're wanting to put in a case, whether it's your own or someone else's, you need to submit this form so I have background on the person and what they are. So basically starts here, section one, case study. You know, these are all the questions that you obviously want to ask, and we go through this in detail in the history taking, but there's those demographics that you really want to know, like height, weight. One thing's not there, as needs to be, is age. And, you know, I know sometimes that's considered like, oh, you're not supposed to ask people their age, but that's on employment applications, guys, not on health. You really need to know somebody's age. So, Susan, I know it's on your labs, but do you want to share your age?
Oh, no, the age is there on the page.
Where is it? Why am I
right
not mistaken? Oh, there it is. It's shot over. It's not in the middle. So there's a line. There's a line problem. There we go. I thought I had it on there. Okay. So we have a 55-year-old female. She's 5'4", 112 pounds. So she's at her ideal weight. She's not underweight or overweight. We have she's married, and she doesn't have children. So her top three concerns are gut repair, autoimmune, and neurodegenerative. Okay. So when we speak to patients and clients, some of them are going to say stuff like that. They're going to give you like a diagnosis or an assessment of what's going on as opposed to symptoms. Some of them are going to say symptoms. So when she says gut repair, tell us what you mean by that. Do you have a diagnosis of something wrong? Or are you suspicious that you have leaky gut?
Well, I was suspicious that I had leaky gut, and then I had this test done, and it verified. And also, the symptoms of the leaky gut had passed. So, in fact, when I did the test, I thought, I don't know why I'm doing this because I'm perfectly fine now. But, in fact, it's there.
Still there, yeah. Yeah, and sometimes, see, that's really a key point to bring up is sometimes people are asymptomatic or become asymptomatic as a result of an intervention. But the problem's still there, and what that really means is, there's two things. One is that they may not be symptomatic and have a problem, and gut is always something we want to look at because they may have joint pain or skin problems or hair loss or, you know, thyroid condition or other things that are really an underlying sign of gut, and they don't know they have a gut problem. So that's why we always say, always evaluate and look to the gut. And then, clearly, if she has autoimmune, there's usually a gut problem, so that's a big thing. But when you give somebody interventions, you get them on some good diet and lifestyle, maybe you do a heavy metal repair, maybe you do a leaky gut repair, and their symptoms go away, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's all healed. And what that really tells to me is that the whole attitude that people have of when they make these diet lifestyle changes of them being temporary is dangerous because, see, if you assumed that once the symptoms went away that everything was better and they said, okay, I'm going back to drinking beer and eating pizza again, and the symptoms came back, it wasn't that it came back, it was that it wasn't really healed in the first place. Well, it could come back, but it's going to. So it really helps to see people and really help them to see that the changes they make need to be lifelong. Now, not 100% lifelong, because sometimes you have to be more restrictive during a healing phase, but that you have to find that maintenance program, because otherwise you run the risk of it coming back. And a case in point is I've worked with people with H. pylori. You know, I've suspected H. pylori. I've done a test for H. pylori. I've confirmed H. pylori. I've put them on protocols to specifically target the H. pylori and retest it, and the H. pylori test is negative. Some people make the mistake of saying, okay, you can get off the H. pylori protocol. What I prefer to do is to keep them on that and then just gradually wean it back over the course of a month or two, and then go back and test again to see how they're doing without the support from whatever those things are. And I give H. pylori as an example, but same thing with leaky gut. Right? If you did a leaky gut repair program and you thought you were fine, you did a test. In this case, the test confirmed you weren't, but you felt fine, so you decided to stop your leaky gut repair, then you run the risk, if it wasn't completely repaired, it was just kind of hidden underground and in a subclinical way. So thank you for bringing that up. So gut repair, autoimmune, and a lot of people will come in and say, I have an autoimmune, I have MS, I have Hashi's, I have lupus or whatever. So she's got indicators for three different ones, Hashimoto's, which is thyroiditis, lupus, which is a systemic, and scleroderma, which affects collagen and connective tissue. So she's got that. And what we know about autoimmune is that there's always a leaky gut component. So healing the leaky gut, even if she felt asymptomatic, if her antibodies were still there, then she's still got to keep working on that gut. That's just my philosophy. And then neurodegenerative, and tell me what that is. Is there a specific condition that you said genetic?
Yeah, so apparently my grandfather had Parkinson's, and my mother has something. I guess it's been called Alzheimer's, but she's had this for 10 years, and she's still functioning fairly well. I mean, she doesn't remember a lot of things, but she can still dress herself and all of that. So she's got some kind of cognitive impairment. Mm. And I'm quite sure that it's been linked to her gut.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so do you have symptoms, or you're just saying that you're concerned that because of this family thing that you might have it and you want to prevent it?
Exactly.
Okay.
The latter.
Perfect. Great. So she's had one surgery, an appendectomy in 1979. She's had two whiplashes in 1980 and 89. Why do we ask about those things? Well, obviously surgeries affect people, and obviously you want to know more about them. People may be telling you certain things, and they're not telling you about other areas where they're impaired, and then you find out that they had a hysterectomy. Oh, but I don't have any female problems. Well, you don't anymore because you removed it. Well, what was going on beforehand? And by the way, those imbalances can still be there. Like, the causes of those imbalances are still be there. So always ask about surgeries. And injuries can affect, a whiplash can actually throw somebody into an inflammatory process, even if they, like, say they had an autoimmune. I remember working with someone with psoriatic arthritis, where they have the psoriasis and then the joints get inflamed as well. And we worked with her. We did a detox program. We did a leaky gut repair. She lost a ton of weight. She was feeling great. And then she got in a car accident. She got whiplash. She got some injuries. And over the course of the next few weeks, the symptoms returned because the body was going into this inflammatory response to help her with the inflammation from the whiplash, and that affected the areas that where her, her weakness in the chain, as Dr. O'Brien likes to call it, that weak link, it starts to show up. So interventions, what she done, she's had done a ketogenic diet, probiotics, and now she's taking Saccharomyces boulardii and lots of greens. Okay. And then current care, types of practitioner, she seems a functional doctor, and she gets acupuncture weekly. So my question here would be, okay, you've had interventions. What worked and what didn't? So was the ketogenic diet effective in terms of lowering antibody levels or in terms of gut symptoms? And how about the probiotics and the greens?
Okay, so the other thing I didn't mention there is that I drink warm lemon water every morning and every evening.
Nice.
And I mix my greens in with that, with my collagen powder. So at first, this was in the latter part of the summer that I started having some, I was having diarrhea. And so I thought it was the lemon juice. And then I was traveling, and the problem had continued, but I continued with the lemon juice while I was traveling. And then coming back here, the symptoms started to go away. So I don't think it had to do with the lemon juice because I've been continuing with that. And then the Saccharomyces?
Saccharomyces. I say Saccharomyces boulardii. Saccharomyces.
So I just started taking that about 5 days ago.
Okay.
And I was taking 3 capsules a day with a meal because of what was reflected on these test results. And I have to say that I had to stop taking it 3 times a day. It was too strong. I was having some stomach pain, like cramping.
Mm.
And so I backed off to 1 a day just to kind of get myself used to it. So I found that was kind of interesting. I would get nauseous. I would get some gas and would just feel like I was getting sick or something, you know, just not feeling well at all. And I'm quite sure it was from that because when I backed off of it, I didn't have that feeling anymore.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. So, you know, when you take probiotics, and this is good to know for folks, when you take them, you've got to make sure it's the right kind. So if you have negative effects, it could be that you're taking too much and you're causing too much of a change. But when you say a stomach pain, are you talking stomach or are you talking intestinal?
I would say that it was probably intestinal.
Okay, so lower down, like where would it be located? So always when people say they have pain in their abdomen, you want to be able to identify where, like what structures are being involved so that you can have more of a clue as to what's going on. So where would you say it's located?
Okay, so I would say halfway down my rib cage between the sternum or the bottom of my rib cage and my belly button.
Below the rib cage. And between the sternum and the belly button. So in the middle,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So now we're thinking, okay, what structure is that?
Well, that would be the stomach, wouldn't it?
No, not between the, you know, no. If it's between the sternum and the belly button down the middle, that's not the stomach, no. And you say midway between the stomach and the belly button?
Yeah, so if you were to go about 2 or 3 inches above the belly button.
Okay, right. Not stomach. Okay. So I encourage you when you get to the digestion, if you haven't done that module yet, to look at the anatomy stuff, in detail because it's really good to understand your landmarks, right?
Okay.
So stomach is on the left hand side, kind of tucked under the rib cage. It pokes out a little bit. Okay. It's on the left side. And
okay.
The pyloric, which is the valve sphincter that goes from there to the small intestine, will dump in around midline. But where you're describing is small intestine.
Okay.
Okay. So that gives a clue. Like if you had said it was the right side lower down towards my hip bone or the right side right underneath my rib, then I would say, you know, if it's right underneath your rib out to the side, I would be starting to think large intestine. But if it's right underneath the rib, but like closer in towards midline, I would think liver gallbladder. So really knowing your anatomy, like looking at the charts and looking at where everything comes together is a really good, you know, good way to go about and kind of understand. So you're getting some pain in your small intestine when you take a probiotic. So I'm going to think, well, maybe there's some small intestinal bacterial overgrowth and the probiotic is aggravating that. That's just one thing, right? When you back off on the amount, is it less?
Yeah, there's nothing happening.
So when you back off on the amount. Okay, so it's amount dependent. So it could be just overloading, but I would be looking at, well, are you constipated or diarrhea now, or you have normal bowel movements 2-3 times a day?
Normal once a day.
Normal once a day. So not quite up to optimal motility in the gut. Right. And when the motility is not so good and you get pain in the small intestine, that could point to an overgrowth, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. Right. And you got to be really careful with what probiotics you take. I don't think Saccharomyces is a what do you call it, lactic acid producer, but it might be. I'd have to look that one up. But whenever someone is taking probiotics and I'm suspicious of a small intestinal bacterial overgrowth or SIBO, then what I find with that is that I prefer to stick with the D-lactic acid free ones, like the bifido, all the bifido species and a few of the lactose that you can look up. So it could be that. So now, you know, we don't know for sure, but everything about how things manifest are clues. And that's why these things are so important, right? Is to really understand how to look at things in a way that you're pulling the right clues together. So we'll keep that tucked away as we go through. You have good habits of yoga, breath work, and walks, which is great. So that keeps the stress levels down. But the negatives are chocolate and coffee. What about the wine? A couple of weeks ago, we were talking about wine, and I hopefully convinced you to get off of it based on your genes. Is that still...
I don't really drink wine, but we would occasionally split a bottle of Prosecco on the weekend, but we don't really do that anymore. We have Kivita instead.
Good. Kivita, yay. Feed those buggers. Yeah. And just, okay, so another thing, Kivita has some probiotic in it. Do you have an issue when you drink Kivita? Does it give you any stomach discomfort or intestinal discomfort?
Okay. No, not at all.
Okay.
And I drink the coconut water, fermented coconut water.
Okay. So, just out of curiosity, when you take a probiotic like that, and we'll look at your GI effects, so we'll see what your probiotic ratios are. But is like, keep that in mind. Is like, okay, if I take this 3 times a day, then I have problem. What if I take other probiotics? So that all helps. Everything we're doing is trying to narrow it down to cause and effect so we can get at the root cause. And it could be a simple food that the person's sensitive to, or it could be a bug, or there's a lot of different things, but we'll get there. So the questioning is always about, like, how did that work? But always never take face value what somebody says. It hurt in my stomach. Well, when I think of it hurt in my stomach, I'm thinking over here on the left-hand side, you know, right about rib cage level. But you had something totally different in mind, so don't be afraid to ask to clarify, because people don't really get it, even professionals. You know, I've had, you know, MDs say, oh, I have a stomach ache, and they're holding their intestine, right? They're holding around their belly button. I'm like, huh, what school did you go to? That's not where the stomach is. And they go, yeah, you know what I mean, right? Because people just use that as, I have a stomach ache, a tummy ache. That's kind of considered an intestinal distress. So chocolate and coffee. I know it wasn't the wine as much. So it was the wine, but also I thought you had some caffeine metabolism snips, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, and I'm really working on weaning off of coffee.
Okay, and your attraction to the coffee, is it the taste and the ritual, or is it related to energy?
Oh, it's, you know, it's having a cappuccino in the morning. It's a thing. It's, you know, and I don't drink a lot of coffee. I'm not the kind of person to make a whole pot and drink a whole pot of coffee, just a shot of espresso. And, you know, I'll have it with water, like an Americano, just for the taste. So it's more the pleasure of it than anything else. So I'm working with matcha, and that seems to be doing really well for me.
Okay, yeah, so weaning is usually a good thing to do with that. But the thing about coffee is, you know, coffee and alcohol actually thin the lining of the intestinal tract. They can actually be damaging to it. So when you're working on a gut issue to get people off, now there's sometimes, if you had your answer been about, well, I need it because I don't have energy if I don't, then we're thinking, okay, there's some adrenal burnout, and what can we do to help this person to get more energy? And I don't necessarily take somebody right off. I try to, you know, substitute in the matcha or the green tea or, you know, yerba mate or something else that's less acidic forming. Like green tea is very alkalizing and also supportive of the liver. So if you can get it to a green tea kind of ritual, then that could be good at as well. Okay, so stress, she's right in the middle as a 5. What are your biggest stressors?
Probably traveling back and forth to Denver and looking after my parents.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's probably the biggest one. And then, you know, getting reintegrated back home and back right. in my routine and getting people to sub classes for me. It's really, you know, just the whole rhythm of the house changes when I have to go and that sort of thing. So that's
a big one. And you probably bring back the worry and concern over mm-hmm. your parents' health. Especially if your mom's, you know, not doing so well. So
yeah, and I'm constantly working on things, you know, emailing with their doctors or medication lists and that sort of thing. So it's full on.
Yeah.
It doesn't stop even when I'm home.
Right. And the yoga and the breath work and the walks, does that help to dissipate it?
Oh, yeah. And I have two dogs, so that really helps as well. And, of course, my husband, who's totally supportive. But, you know, and I have my garden, which is really nice, although that can be stressful unto itself. But generally speaking, I have nice ways of
dealing with it. Now, do you do anything like heart math or tapping or things that you can do throughout the day? Because yoga and meditation, breath work you could, but yoga you'd have to, you know, stop and do poses and walks or more discreet, you know, entities. Do you do things like, do you incorporate your breath work throughout your daily rituals?
Yeah, I'll just kind of pause sometimes in the middle of the day and just take some deep breaths just to kind of, you know, because obviously when we get going throughout the day, we stop breathing properly. So I'll stop and just take some deep breaths before I eat my lunch, that sort of thing.
Okay. Right. Yeah. So incorporating that and taking those regular breaks just helps it when the stress levels get high. So your current medications are WP thyroid. So now you can usually tell before they tell, she did mention Hashimoto's, but a lot of times they won't mention a particular condition that they've had till you look at their medication list and you start to ask them and you go, oh yeah, that's right. I had hypertension and they gave me this or whatever. So thyroid, and you've been on thyroid for how long?
It's been a couple years now.
Okay. Always important to ask how long they've been on a medication, because if they're having symptoms and you're seeing they're on a certain medication and then you find out they've only been on for 2 weeks, it's a lot different. So a couple of years. So you should be at a stabilized dose if it's working. If it's going to work, it's going to work. 500 milligrams of slow release niacin. And what was the purpose of that one?
Well, my functional doctor put me on that. I had a VAP test done I had some high LDL particle numbers.
Okay.
Yeah, so he put me on the slow-release niacin, and my cholesterol was slightly high. It was more the HDL. I've got super high HDL.
Uh-huh.
So he, you know, he just recommended that just to kind of bring it down a little bit, and it's, you know, it worked immediately. Like a month later, it was completely different, the blood test results.
Okay. All right. So, for those of you who don't know what a VAP is, you know, when people get their cholesterol tested, they get the cholesterol, HDL, LDL, et cetera, and that gives you one picture, but those are the larger particles. And the smaller particles are more telling. So the LDL, the VLDL, then there's different breakdowns within that, ApoEs and ApoB and A and all that. So it's a really good test to do on people who may have a normal cholesterol profile, but a family history and dietary history. Are you guys clanking in the background, or is that somebody else's line that's open?
I'm sorry. I thought my mic was closed. I had to let my dog in.
Oh, okay. Got it. All right. I didn't know if somebody else had snuck in or whatever. So we're basically wanting to ask about the different medication, the different stuff she's on. So now I know that, you know, there's a family history, or there's some sort of lipid dysregulation there, and that's why she's taking that. So it's always important to ask why you're taking the medication or why they think they're taking it and what, how long. And we have a chart in our master tracker that allows you to put all that information so you can keep track of it from time to time. Because as you work with more and more people, you get them all confused. You don't remember who had what and what they were doing. So you can actually put the date they started it and why they started it. And you can actually give it to them to fill in as well if you want to. She's taken bias, so that's saying, okay, the female hormones are out of balance, and a milligram of testosterone, and then also LDN, and I'm assuming that's for the thyroid.
Yes.
Yeah. And LDN is low-dose naltrexone. It's a drug that's used for addiction. It's actually used very commonly, but in high dose. low-dose naltrexone has been found to be helpful for people with autoimmune diseases to decrease inflammation, but at very low doses, 1.5 is the dose that she probably started at 1.5 and worked up to the 4.5. That's usually how it's done. And they do it a lot for autoimmune diseases. It's used in Lyme disease as well. And there's a number of other places. At that level, it's not, it doesn't seem to have side effects. So if somebody's going to go on a medication, that could be helpful. It also helps with motility. So the, what do they call that? The, migrating motor complex in the gut, which is what usually gets slowed down when we have a lot of sympathetic overdrive and the vagus nerve doesn't get to work real well, that LDN is actually a motility producer. And there's a number of those that can help, but LDL is a drug that's often prescribed for people with SIBO. So when you start to see these medications, the more and more you'll start to understand. So she's got some male-female hormone imbalance, reproductive hormone imbalances. She's got some thyroid imbalances. Got some cardiovascular things going on and autoimmune. So there's a bunch of imbalances.
Good thing,
yeah?
One good thing is that I'm off the Cortef. So I was on 15 milligrams, then down to 10 milligrams, and now I'm completely off of the cortisol.
Great.
And I didn't realize that LDN was prescribed for SIBO.
Yeah, because that is a motility. And if you'll see it in the list in our digestive module as well.
Cool.
Okay, good. Just jotting down a few notes. So nutritional supplements, this is also telling. You can tell the people who are like reading everything out there and just like throwing, you know, remedies at it, or somebody who's thought it through, or somebody who's worked with, like Susan said, a functional doctor. So she's on magnesium taurate, 400 milligrams, lysine, and lysine. So I start to think, oh, why is she on lysine? Do you have an issue with herpes or, you know, cold sores in any way? Is that why you're on lysine?
I think it's got to do with the bees because we went over my SNPs and you recommended that I take lysine. So I take the drops.
Okay. Yeah, I don't remember. It might have been one of those SNPs. So see what I mean? It was like how many SNPs ago was that I talked to you? I don't even remember. So the more you know, the more things come out in the moment, and I wouldn't be able to reproduce why I did that because I'd have to have all those labs in front of me to go back and see why I recommended it based on her SNPs. And it might have had something to do with arginine imbalance or something.
That's it. That was it.
Yeah. Okay. Good. And also because you were doing the coffee and the chocolate, and I felt like based on something there that was interfering with it, you know, and people
right.
get breakouts of herpes from that because of the excess arginine in those foods. Okay. So glutathione. So that's an antioxidant. The cream's great. Is that the Apex one that you're doing?
Yeah, the
Oxycell. Yeah, and that's a really good, I've used it a lot with folks with autoimmune. I've actually had people who have autoimmune thyroid actually put the dose on the neck. You always apply these topical creams in places where it's thin so that the circulation is close to the surface. So that's the glutathione, I'm assuming, was related to the inflammation from the autoimmune.
Yes, but I also had SNPs that I didn't have enough glutathione.
Right.
Action.
Great. And then the P5P, which is pyridoxal 5-phosphate, is a B6. It's the active form of B6. And I often recommend that when people have reproductive hormone imbalances, when they have neurotransmitter imbalances, et cetera. And there's also some SNPs related to the glutathione sulfation pathway that needs to be. So I'm not sure how long have you been taking that one.
You know, I just started the lysine, glutathione, and the P5P and the Neo40 after we did the case study. So that was about a month and a half ago.
Okay, great. And then OsteoPrime, that's obviously something that's a bone health formula. And were these the rest of these things that you were recommended by a practitioner or?
So the reason I'm taking the OsteoPrime Forte is because my entelopeptides are consistently high.
Okay.
There was one time where it dropped down into the 40s, which is in the normal range, but, you know, it was a one-off. So every time we take it, I'm up in the 80s.
Okay.
And so I'm not fully convinced that it's got to do with my thyroid medication. And so anyway, the collagen hydrolysate I started taking because of, you know, weird tweaky knee kind of stuff, and also just to build up my collagen because that shows up in the entelepeptides. So I, you know, there's some concern with bone loss, and I haven't quite gotten to the root cause of why it's happening.
Okay. And how long have you been gluten-free? I think we talked about this before, and it hasn't been all that long as far as I remember.
It hasn't been. It's only been about a month.
Okay. So there you have it. That can contribute. Gluten can contribute to bone loss. So let's see where that goes. And also, you know, gluten contributes to poor absorption of nutrients, which then can lead to that as well. Okay, so let's see where you go with that. Mighty Maca overall for the hormone health, adrenal health, et cetera. Raw reserve greens, that's just some of your greens. The lemon juice you mentioned. The methyl B12 spray, did you start that as a result of the test, or had you been doing that before?
I've been doing that for quite some time.
Great. Okay. And how much, what's the dose? You always want to find out doses on these things, which is why use the chart we have in the master tracker. The master tracker chart is invaluable, and it just gives you that snapshot.
Yeah. So the dose is 500 micrograms.
Okay. So small dose. Yeah. Yeah. I get concerned if I don't know somebody's SNPs and they're on a high dose of methyl and they're telling me they have anxiety, because that can be contributing. I've also had people who had been trying for years to get their MCV, which is an indirect indicator of B12 status, up, and it just wasn't going up even on 5,000 micrograms a day of methyl B12. And then we got her SNPs back, and I'm like, oh my God, that's really not a good thing. That's going to impact your nervous system. We took her off of it, and it was night and day. We put her on hydroxy B12. I don't remember what your SNPs were, but at the 500, I'm not worried about it at all. The vitamin D, depending on where her vitamin D is, if your vitamin D is in the toilet, 2000 is not going to be enough. If your vitamin D is up in the 50s or 60s, 2000 would be fine.
Yeah, so I'm at 80, and the range is 30 to 100.
Yeah, perfect. So that'll maintain. It's not going to throw you into an excess. But watch it. You know, periodically take it again just to make sure that that's enough. Like if there's times when, you know, you're stuck indoors for months at a time in the winter or something, you may have to up it.
Mm-hmm.
Pregnenolone, 2.5 milligrams, that's the drops. That's the Biomatrix drops.
Yeah.
And the 2.5 on the DHEA, and that's, do you spread that out across the day?
Yeah, I take a drop in the morning and then a drop in the afternoon.
Okay, and that was based on what?
That's based on what my doctor and I have worked out, just to kind of keep things up, because everything's been down. All of the sex hormones have been down.
Okay.
And my cortisol levels have been off. So, you know, now things are coming back to normal. And one thing that I left out in this list is this H2 Absorb tablet that I just started taking a few weeks ago. And I'm convinced that that's the reason why I've been able to go off the cortisol without any problem.
Great. Great. So you were on the Cortef for how long?
I was on Cortef for about 2 years.
Okay. So your adrenals are clearly coming back, and your adrenals coming back is going to affect your sex hormones. So I mean, I think the pregnenolone is good. Have you done your adrenal testing?
I've got a Dutch test here.
Perfect.
So I need to do that next. And then, you know, I'm clear of the Cortef, so it'll be a true test.
Yeah. Yeah, and we'll get to see how well your hormones are actually doing for you.
Okay.
Yep. Okay, cool. And if you want to know, like, are you on the right dose at all, like, do you need it, you could do the get off of it for a week or two and see. But if you, like, go into misery when you go off of your progesterone, estrogen, testosterone, then do it while you're on the thing, and we'll know how well that's doing. So we have to take that into account when we look at it. The one thing not to do, like, people ask me, should I keep people on their hormones when they get them tested or not? It's one or the other, right? You don't start them on something and then test their hormones like a couple of weeks later, because it's going to be inaccurate. And you don't stop them like, and then test them just over the next couple of days, because it's not going to be accurate. You really need to be off of it for a couple of weeks in order to let them go to baseline. But if you've been on hormones for a while, you want to know what that hormone is doing. So I would take the test with the hormone.
Okay.
Okay. So she's also taking zinc and 60 milligrams every other day. Got it. And DHA drops. Okay. So we got a good picture of her just by looking at what she's taking, right? And this is really important. And if you can actually, shorten your history taking with people by having them fill out the right form. So if you go into the master tracker and you print off that sheet, or you take a digital form and you give it to the person, then you're going to be able to get a lot of information without having to go through all this. And you're making notes. So as you go through, you're making notes because you know what these things are for. You're going to guess. You ask some quick questions and you can shorten your time in taking the history and get to it. But you get a big, really great picture just with that. So the dietary habits, she's dairy on occasion, chocolate and coffee are some of the things she's exposed to. She's listed no toxic exposures, and then some pertinent lab findings here. So homocysteine is 5.7. That's reasonable. The calcium is fine, but it's down. So we'd want to be watching that to see if it's a trend or if it's just an isolated thing. C-reactive protein, less than 0.1. Excellent. Vitamin D is 80. Excellent. Copper is 109. You know, it's on the lower end, so it's not necessarily going to get in the way of the zinc, but the zinc is also at the lower end. Always have to be careful with making sure that the copper-zinc ratios are balanced. Selenium is good, B6. And how are these tested? Were these all serum tests? Yeah. So one thing to keep in mind, and you'll learn this in the micronutrients module, is that not all the serum tests are created equally. So some of them don't mean anything, like magnesium in the serum. Yeah, you need to look at RBC. Zinc in the serum. It's all right. Selenium might be okay. D is certainly fine. Copper, I think, is good. B6, I don't trust it. I'd really rather do it. But she did do her RBC magnesium, and it looks like it's at the lower end of the range. B12, I don't really use B12 in the serum very much, but if somebody has a very high B12 in the serum and a high MCV, which would indicate that they're large red blood cells and that they have a low B12, then I'm thinking that they probably have a methylation issue, because the B12 builds in the serum and can't be converted or methylated in order to be utilized in the body. So there's a lot of things like that that you keep in mind. Vitamin A is decent in the serum. It's 55. Parathyroid is fine. Ionized calcium. This is really a thorough panel. We very rarely get people doing all of this. What prompted it? Was this something that your functional doctor recommended?
Well, I asked him for these. He's very good. I get to, I'll send an email to the assistant and give her a list, and he'll order it for me.
Okay.
So a lot of this stuff I wanted to know about, obviously because of the bone situation.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm supplementing on the B6 and the 12.
Right.
I found it interesting that the 6 showed up high, because I haven't been taking it that long.
I don't know that it's accurate. So I don't know that B6 in the serum is accurate. So it may be similar to the B12. I don't know for sure, but it may be similar that you're not activating it, or you're not utilizing it, or that pathway is blocked.
Right.
And it's not utilizing it and staying up. We really want to look at tissue levels of nutrients as opposed to serum levels, because you'll learn that better in that micronutrients. Like, for each nutrient, there is a place that it's best measured.
Okay.
So you can't necessarily go by that. And a lot of people will make the mistake of having their doctor, they run these tests, and then they go off of their supplements because the levels are fine or they're high. And really it can be a paradoxical high, and it doesn't really mean that much. So it's really good to know which ones are good to test. And the NutriVal, which you did, we'll look at that. Test in like the red blood cells or the white blood cells, or it tests in the compartment that they're most likely to be accurate.
Okay.
TPO is 13. Had your TPO been much higher?
Yeah, it's gone as high as 48.
Okay. All right. So borderline.
Down, yeah, to what it was when I first diagnosed myself with Hashimoto's.
Okay. And then why do you think it So you're saying it was there and then it went up and then it came back down again.
Mm-hmm.
And do you have an idea of what triggered it to go up?
You know, at the time that it was going up, I didn't know as much as I do now, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But I would probably say it had to do with gluten.
Mm-hmm.
I never ate a lot of gluten anyway, but I, you know, if I got a really good baguette, I'd have a baguette. So I have a feeling it was just going off the rails and
yep.
not fully realizing.
Yeah, wasn't
it
really knowing. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, so she's doing exercise. She's getting outdoors. She's relaxing. She's, you know, she's got decent habits here. She's drinking greens 5 or more times a week, eating vegetables, drinking alcohol, which she said she's cut back on, but I would say, you know, eliminating the alcohol and caffeine while you're in the healing stages. And then once you're balanced, then you go back and test. Can I have, you know, how many glasses of wine can I get in, and how much coffee can I get in without throwing myself out of balance? Because it's
right.
really, you know, it's all about balance, and we want to make sure that we're there. And I just like to see, dedicate, get people dedicated during a healing phase, especially with autoimmunity, to get themselves in balance and then find out, you know, what do you need to do to stay in balance? Purified water, sleeping, I mean, all that stuff's good. So we'll look at a couple of things before we do. I'm going to check to see if there's any questions or inputs or anything at all. So if you are on the web, you can go ahead and, okay, if I find my web thing.
I did want to add something regarding LDN.
Yes.
I found that shifting the time that I take it from before bed, which is the time that it's recommended, I shifted it to 12 noon because I could not get a restful sleep on LDN.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
So it's too stimulating.
And there's conflicting views about whether you really have to take it at night. But, you know, for me, if I can't get my sleep, then, you know,
everything's off, right? You
yeah.
don't want to, yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, I agree with you. So, you know, when you look at what, you look at the way things are recommended to be taken, you have to also look at the person. Like, I had somebody who, if she took probiotics at night, she slept better. Like, okay, take them at night. I had other people who take them at bed and they're stimulated. So don't take them at night. We have to adapt not just to what's kind of the recommended protocol, because there is no protocol. It's all a matter of finding what works for the person and what makes sense for them. So I'm going to look to see on the chat. Let me get this out of the way. The chat box is here. And see, Lynn, are there any things on the chat that I should be addressing? If you could just open your line and tell me yes or no, that way I don't have to go through this whole thing. Much learning. Yay. So diaphragm said, is there a possibility of that pain being muscular? Well, the reason I didn't think I didn't think any of that was because she said that her pain was between her sternum and her belly button, and it only happened when she took the probiotics. Yeah. Espelardia is a type of yeast, yes. It's usually in a spore form, and it's usually inert. It doesn't aggravate people, but it certainly can. Sharon wants to know where you got that lab work done. Was it just through Quest Labs or something like that?
Yeah, those are all Quest Labs.
Quest Labs, yeah.
I wanted to add one thing. It's quite helpful. You can open your own account on the Quest Lab site. They have a patient portal. And so when your labs are ready, you get an email notification that it's ready. And then you go on the site, you see your labs, and the neat thing is that they have a graph that shows you trending, like the master tracker.
Mm.
So everything is in there. Every test that you've ever done through Quest is in there. You pay a $10 fee to get the back lab that, you know, from that time to now, whenever you open your account.
And when you say can open an account, do you have to still get a doctor's prescription to order the tests?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So it's not like direct labs where you can order it yourself. Okay. So Allison says she's on Armour Thyroid, so it would be the total TFT. I was concerned as she seems to medicalize so much on HC. Oh, she's talking about a client of hers. Okay. Direct Labs adrenal saliva test. Okay. Direct Labs, no. So test wise, Direct Labs is where you can go to get the blood work. So if your doctor or your client's doctor won't order their blood work for them and have it covered on their insurance, you go to Direct Labs and they're much less expensive. The adrenal saliva test, would be more like a BioHealth or Diagnostics. They have the adrenal saliva test. And then Dutch is dried urine test for comprehensive hormones. And that's basically a 24-hour, no, it's not a 24-hour, it's a spot urine test that you take at certain times throughout the day, similar to what you do for the adrenal. The Dutch is much more comprehensive than a saliva adrenal test in that it covers not just the adrenals, but it also covers all your sex hormones and all the metabolites. So we'll look at those on some of these calls. Yeah, I think that's it. A couple of other questions. Let's see before we move on. Yeah, love the idea. Daddy said the idea of printing off the sheet and giving it to them as part of their thing. You know, you can include a sheet like that so that they fill it in. I like to actually have them do it online, and I upload the master tracker to a Google Drive. And we share it. So I'll say when you get your labs, just pop them in. When you change your supplement doses, pop them in. And it works for some people and other people don't, and they just have to do it myself. But it's nice to have that shared, so anytime you make a change to it, they see it and you don't end up having to send them a new one every time. And somebody asked where that is. Yeah. So if you haven't been to one of Lynn's orientations and you're new, I highly recommend that you do it. I guess we won't be doing it in December. Maybe we'll do it earlier in January. But you really, really want to do that because she'll take you through the entire site. And there's a recording of it, too. So if you go on the site and look under recordings, you'll see an orientation recording. And that it's really worthwhile to watch. Oops. Lynn had some, Allison had somebody whose report, she didn't do the right samples. Oh boy. Okay. All right. So, let's see, where do you get the Dutch? Oh, wait. Yeah, so Dutch will ship overseas. You guys can order the Dutch directly. You can call them up, and it's on their site. You can order it as a client, and clients can order it directly, so that's nice. We also have it on our site. It's cheaper than getting it on their site, I think, because we pass on our discount.
I wanted to add one thing about the Quest question.
Sure.
It could very well be that you could order labs directly from them. I just don't even think about it because I'm in Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Quest generally doesn't. That's what I was curious about, if they had a special thing. I don't think they do like LabCorp. They usually have an arrangement with a company that does that because they have to have – they require a doctor's prescription, and what Direct Labs does is they have practitioners in every state that sign off on the lab orders. So I don't know what kind of liability that puts them into, but it certainly we're glad that they do. And I see Valerie has her hand up. I'm going to see if she has a question, and then we'll go on and finish up with the lab. So, Valerie, did you have a question, or was that just that you could hear me?
That was that I could hear you.
Great. Just checking. Want to make sure. Don't want to leave anybody out in the cold. Okay. So let's go back, and I have some labs for Susan, these two. So we have the Genova's GI Effects and we have the OAT test from Great Plains. So let's look at the Genova GI Effects. They have some cool little pictures in the front. And they, you know, it's green when it's okay. And it's, I don't know. I don't know. I don't do this test often enough. So we're just going to, I like numbers. I don't like pictures as much. So diversity. She's got a low diversity. Okay, so this is lower, and this is higher.
I was so surprised at that.
Yeah, So the bugs that live in her gut, she doesn't have as much variety as she needs to. So, you know, some people would say, okay, I'm going to go switch to a 36 strain instead of a, you know, 12 strain. And in reality, a lot of it is making your own probiotics can be very helpful because you take a cabbage which has organisms on it from where it was grown, and then you grow it and it picks up organisms from your house, and then you can stick a bunch of probiotic in it. So diversity is important, and sometimes diversity goes down when there's some kind of an overgrowth. So I'm just looking at this as an overview right now, and then we're going to look at in a bit. So relative abundance, you've got more gut bugs than the healthy cohort. So there may be some critters that are taking over and are dominating, so you don't get much of a diversity there. So that's all the stuff we're going to be looking for. So when I look here, so we look at digestion and absorption. This is the opposite. I'm so used to looking at diagnostics and I'm not doctor's data where they do all the bugs first and then this stuff last. So what we're looking at is functional stuff on her. So elastase, that's pancreatic elastase. Hers is in a good range. You know, so pancreatic function is probably okay. But then we have products of protein breakdown, very low. So that's valerate, isobutyrate, and isovalerate. So those are low. Fecal fats are a little on the high side. It's in the yellow. Triglycerides are a little on the high side. Long chain fatty acids are a little on the high side. Phospholipids are a little on the high side. So to me, that smacks of fat malabsorption, right? Because you shouldn't be getting fat in your stool. It should be broken down. And by the time it reaches the stool, you should have bile acids. Okay. So I'm thinking that there's fat malabsorption going on here.
Mm-hmm.
As far as inflammation, look at this, okay? Calprotectin is okay, eosinophilic protein. These are inflammatory markers. But look at her secretory IgA. It's off the charts. So it's like her secretory IgA is an immune and an antibody, you know, immune factor that's in the mucous membrane. So it's saying that her body's working really hard to get rid of some overgrowth, right? So we want to find out what that overgrowth is. The other thing is her short chain fatty acids are really low. And that would affect the diversity as well, because we need those short chain fatty acids to feed the good bacteria. So they act as catalysts for those, and they also help to support the wall and the healing of the wall of the intestine. So hers are very, very low, her short-chain fatty acids. Her butyrate is okay, but her acetate and propionate, so it's mostly the butyrate. The acetate, interesting. Interesting that it shows up so low. Oh, the butyrate concentration, interesting. Her percentage butyrate is high, but the actual amount. Okay, so the actual total amount, I was confused at reading this, but the actual total amount of the fatty acids is low. The ratios and concentration between them favors butyrate, which is good. Propionate, you know, not so much, but butyrate. But she just doesn't have enough of these, right? Look at how low her butyrate is. Now, butyrate can be found in foods like butter. Butyrate can be taken as a supplement. And butyrate gets produced by some of the good bacteria that ought to be growing there. So the combination of, for a little while, maybe feeding some butyrate to this concentration to help them grow, and then making sure that you have plenty of diversity going in. Do you eat any foods, probiotic containing foods, yogurt, kefir, a lot of them, or just a little bit now and then? How do you do with that?
Well, I don't have yogurt and kefir. I'll have some fermented vegetables.
Okay.
I'll have fermented coconut milk.
Regularly?
Sorry?
Regularly?
Yeah, I do the fermented coconut milk every day, twice a day, one tablespoon twice daily.
Tablespoon is what you have? Okay. So that maybe it's just not enough. Maybe it's just not enough. And resistant starch also feeds these guys. So if you're on a ketogenic diet, you're not getting any resistant starch. I'm not a, you know, big fan of a lot of resistant starch, but, you know, things like when you go on a ketogenic diet, you're off of things like lentils and also, of course, grains and potatoes and all that. But nuts and seeds have decent amounts of resistant starch as well. So that might be something to help feed them. Okay.
Yeah, I do a lot of nuts and seeds.
Okay. So it's a matter of, okay, why does she have such low butyrate concentration? So
and I do ghee.
Mm-hmm.
Olive oil, you know, I
ghee's not going to help. Well, ghee, I don't think butyrate. Well, ghee would have. No, I don't know, because when they concentrate it out. So looking at this, a temporary solution while we figure out why this is happening would be to get some butyrate in you. And, you know, you can take a butyrate supplement as well. Because I'm not sure. Check into ghee whether when the process of clarification removes butyrate. I'm not sure.
Okay.
Okay. So let's look at our bugs. Let's look at our concentration of bugs. So bacterioides are high. But which one is that? Barcella is in the green. I don't know some of these. Odiobacter is super high. I don't know enough about that, but it's really, really high. Really, really high. And Prevetta is okay. So we've got some bacterial overgrowth going on in the gut, and that could be crowding out the good bacteria and creating that lack of diversity that we saw on the other page. Under the Firmicutes, we've got the they measure a lot of bugs. We've got this one growing. We've got the Fecala bacterium. Some of these names, I'm just not good at pronouncing. Pseudoflavonfractor is high. So you got a bunch of bugs, a bunch of bacterial overgrowth going on here. So you want to address that. And the question becomes why, right? It could be a motility issue, and you are on LDN, which would help with that. You want to look at vagus nerve stuff, too, to keep things moving through. You can't tell from a stool test if there's actually SIBO, but you can guess that, there's a lot of bacteria overgrowing, and these tend to like to grow in the bacteria if the motility's not that great. So that can be a problem. E. coli's a little bit on the high side as well. There's a lot of them, a lot of bacteria. Did they do the cultures, the sensitivity to see what grows and what doesn't?
I don't think so.
Okay, because you're looking at your normal bacteria, your good flora, your lactobacillus is non-existent. Your bifido is really high, which is the opposite of what I usually see, by the way, because usually people are so taking lactobacillus and their bacteria, the bifido. You might want to look at adding some of the D-lactic acid-free lactobacillus strains, and I think Helveticus might be one, and yeah, I don't remember the exact ones, but if you just look up D-lactic acid-free, Custom Probiotics has some of those. And you might add some of that. You get a powder and you just add some of that to your yogurt or whatever you're making or eating.
Okay. Helveticus is one particular type?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure Helveticus is, and I don't remember the others. Is Steph on the call? Steph's the one that knows all those bacteria. And then mycology, you're not showing any problems with overgrowth of yeast, so that's good. No over parasites, that's good. No fecal occult blood, form stool, and they did not do the sensitivities. So that is always, whenever you're running any of these tests with them, make sure that they're going to run sensitivities, so they can see what actually is going to get rid of those bacteria. So when you're going to look at getting those bacteria under control, you know, you've got to do all the things to create a good terrain. You're, you know, getting your lactobacillus up a little bit, but overall your good bacteria is good. But I would, no, it's just disappeared and nothing's showing. I would say that you want to find some good bacterial stuff to get yourself under control. You said you started what? You started something recently. As a result of this.
Oh, the Bilardi.
The Bilardi. You know, I just don't think that that's necessarily the right one with you here. You could do it. It's not bad, but I think that you need some antimicrobial stuff to get rid of this stuff. And I would alternate. So you can alternate like 5 days on of berberine and 5 days on of oregano and look up, back into the module that we have, the CMDS module on gut bugs, and figure out which of the which of the ones are good for bacteria, and then alternate them. But don't take the same one over and over, because I've seen people become resistant. Okay?
Okay. And the allergy research, what's it called, tricycline?
Yeah, the tricycline can be good because it helps with everything, but you don't have any signs of parasite, and you don't have any signs of the other. I think I had mentioned that in terms of your mother, because she had had.
Right.
Yeah. Give me a second. No, I mentioned it. Let me look at your Dutch test. I know I mentioned it in terms of your mother's Dutch test, but let me see. Yeah, so you've got bacteria. Yeah, so you've got some yeast and fungal markers. So here's the thing. It's good when you can do the Dutch and the stool test, because sometimes the bugs might not be in enough volume, or they may not have been captured in the specimen. But the Dutch test and the organic acid test will tell you if there's markers that are indicative of overgrowth. So that first set here are yeast and fungal markers. So when you have an overgrowth of these, you're going to produce it. So that's why. So I think the tricycline would be good, but I would alternate some of the bacterial stuff. You may want to alternate that with some other stuff, because I'd hate to see you develop a sensitivity. Caprylic acid is a good one. There's a number of them. I don't want to, rack my brain for all the other ones that are listed, but there's a bunch that can work for the yeast, and caprylic acid is one of them. What's the name of that? Pau di Arco is another one. There's a number of them that you can use, and I would alternate them. And remember, the reason I said the tricycline for your mom is because, she's 85 and in assisted living and doesn't really have the wherewithal to be taking a whole bunch of stuff and rotating it on a 5-day rotation.
Right.
But you can, right? You can.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's the best way to approach it. And you can do it in whole herbs. You can do it in tinctures. You can do it in capsules. I always like to do either tinctures or powders as much as I can, just because you can titrate doses. Especially when you start to take this, you can get bad die-off if you just take a full dose of something.
And then what about nystatin in my case?
I probably wouldn't. I would be approaching this from the standpoint of creating the terrain, and it's not like you have a serious, persistent overgrowth that's showing up. Yeah, I wouldn't.
It's a bit off the charts to take the nystatin then.
Say it again.
It's a little over the top to take the nystatin.
I think it's over the top. I mean, I avoid the pharmaceutical approach unless I can't get the terrain balanced other way.
Okay.
That's just my opinion. I took nystatin for a year. It didn't do me any good back when I was in my 20s.
Okay.
Till I established the right terrain. So you've got some bacterial markers. You've got some yeast markers. Clostridia, a little bit on the high side. So yeah, I think that alternating that is going to be a good effect. And also really working on, getting off the caffeine, alcohol, getting off of any sugars that you're on, and just really looking at that. Your oxalates are a little high, and that's probably a leaky gut thing, that they're seeping into the system. Your glycerate and glycolic are okay. So I don't think it's like I'm not convinced that it's like a genetic thing. I think it's a leaky gut thing. And we talked about that on the other call.
Mm-hmm.
Mitochondria markers, you've got a few that are on the low end of the normal range and a little bit outside of it. Like one is malic acid, or malic, and it's related to malic acid citrate. The one that's the lowest is a aconitic, and I want to look back up on their cheat sheet to see. We've got a module that's coming out as a bonus very soon for CMDS that we offered during our last launch, and it's an interpretation sheet for the organic acids and all the stuff that's related to the gut, so you can see some of that stuff in there. Neurotransmitters, yeah.
The ones that you just mentioned, are those 30, 31, and 32?
Yeah, those are the mitochondrial markers, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and if you look at, glutaric acid, you look at your Krebs cycle, you can see blockages. So if you get a blockage, you want to look at, well, what's some of the cofactors before and after? And I think they mention it in the write-up. Let me see. I'm looking at your neurotransmitter markers right now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so the VMA is low, related to norepinephrine, epinephrine. And that could be related to some adrenal stuff as well. Your serotonin markers are low. So tryptophan metabolites. Do you have a problem with depression or anxiety?
No.
No. And maybe maybe part of this might be from the gut stuff. If there's, they contribute to gut motility. So
it,
yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's so interesting.
Yeah. Okay. So you know what? You can look at it. I'm not necessarily prescribing anything in particular, but there's a combo from Pure Encapsulations called Modal Pro, and it's got some serotonin precursors, and it's got some. I think it has. I don't remember if it has amla and ginger, and it has a bunch of other things that help with the motility. That might be a nice one to look at.
Okay.
And that could help with that imbalance there.
Now, what about this quinolonic acid? The 5-HIAA ratio?
Yeah, so yours are all low. The reason the ratio is high is because of the ratio between, right? So your 5-IAA is really,
okay.
They're all low. So I don't even take that thing into an account at this point. I'm usually concerned about that when those numbers are high and the ratio is high. Like oftentimes we'll see a high quinolinic and a low 5-IAA. But yours are all low. So the ratio doesn't mean much to me at that point.
Okay.
I'll give you a look at the homo vanillic and the vanilla mandelic. Yeah, that's a bad ratio, the HLA, because you have, you know, a good number, but then a very low, protective homo, HVA. So, you know, it could be an adrenal thing. It could be a nervous system thing. It could be precursors and that sort of thing. Norepinephrine and epinephrine. Tyrosine can be involved there. So an insufficiency in tyrosine. And it might be an amino acid thing in low stomach acid that you're not getting some of these neurotransmitter precursor amino acids. So the tryptophan and the tyrosine. Could be a problem. And the fact that you have thyroid issues says to me that maybe the tyrosine is low because tyrosine's a core part of thyroid the molecule.
Right.
So, I mean, you could look at doing like a 500 milligram tyrosine. I would do that probably in the morning and then 5-HTP late afternoon or evening or bedtime or whatever and just see if that brings anything into balance. Over time.
Okay.
But the rest of this looks decent. You know, a little on the low side for the folate metabolism. These are all, you know, ketones. I'm not concerned about low or high. I mean, if you're on a high ketogenic diet, I expect to see them way off the top. But that says to me that you're not really running on ketones at this point. And some of the nutritional markers, so the B6 is low, and it's looking at pyridoxic. The methylmalonic, which is good, that's a good indicator of B12 functionally, and that's good. The panathetic is just an actual measure. The D3 is, the riboflavin is good. The ascorbate's low. So I don't know where you're at with that, but given that you have all these female hormone imbalances and you just got off the core test, that I would say that you need to support the adrenals with vitamin C plus the inflammatory pathways. So I don't know I don't remember seeing vitamin C on your list, but if you're
I'm taking 3,000 milligrams a day of powder.
Yeah. So we don't know if that's like way too low for you or not. So I would do the vitamin C calibration, which means either you spend a morning calibrating and taking it. We have that in on the micronutrient module, or you just do the thing where you're taking 3,000 and tomorrow you take 4,000 and 2 days later you go to 5,000 and you keep watching for bowel movements.
Okay.
And increase and then get yourself on your ideal amount.
Okay.
Okay. I think we're good. I'm going to move on to, amino acids low on this test doesn't mean anything. You really would have to follow it up with a a serum or a urine. This is usually when they're testing the amino acids here, they're looking for high, which would be inborn errors of metabolism. So the phenylalactic, and let me look, see if they say back here, let me see, phenylalactate. Yeah, so see this where it says low values for the aminos is the absence of genetic disorders, so they're not associated with inadequate protein. High values are an issue, but I don't see anything written about that one, so I might look that one up because I don't know off the top of my head. The one amino acid that's high, to see what pathway that falls in. Usually I have all my cheat sheets when I'm looking this stuff.
Okay, and then indicators of detox, the aspartame salicylate, that's just above amino acid.
Okay, there we go. The pyroglutamic. So that's your glutathione again, right? And we talked about that before.
Oh.
The first one, the pyroglutamic, that's
okay.
Related to glutathione, it's a precursor. And this one is related to gut bugs. So that's high because of gut bugs.
Okay. Good
okay.
To know.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So let's get, what time is it? Oh, a little bit of time left. Let's get Miss Mary Lynn on the phone. Unmute you. Hi, Mary Lynn.
Hi.
All right, so we're going to go and move on to, I'm going to pause, I'm going to stop the share, and then I'm going to stop the recording, and then I'm going to start a new recording, so we have two, one for each case.
Okay.
So stop recording, and then as soon as it lets me, I will record.